everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about that fabulous organization, to join their ranks, or to learn about their yearly writers conference, you can go to pnwa.org. You know, I, as old as I am, 47 years to be exact, almost 48, I am still learning. I am still learning to this day that you can't really know someone until you meet them. It sounds obvious enough when you say it, but I have often made the mistake of thinking that I do. For instance, I sometimes think I know the writers when I read their books, and that could certainly be the case of today's guest, Fred Waitzkin. Now, Fred, you might think you know Fred if you had read his best-selling memoir, Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was turned into a great movie by the same title, or you might think you know him if you pick up a copy of his pulse-pounding debut novel, The Dream Merchant. But I can assure you, you won't really know him until you meet him, because that's why the book is the book, and the man is the man, and why we have him on a show like this, so we can actually meet him. Fred, welcome to the show.
It's great to have you. You've got me smiling with that introduction.
Well, let me ask you, is it true? Your first three books were nonfiction. They were Searching for Bobby Fischer, about you and your relationship with your son, who was a child chess prodigy, and then The Last Marlin and The Mortal Game. And so, but you were a part of certainly the first two. Do people meet you and think they know you?
I think that they know you, because at least in my memoirs, I wrote about myself pretty nakedly. That was sort of my style. I put myself out there, or at least I put the persona that was Fred out there. And I think that I think that there is a difference. I mean, I think that the guy that you sit with in a bar and you meet, or you might chat with in friendship, is different than the writing persona. But I think that writing persona is a true person also.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting question. I mean, I hadn't thought about it quite that way before. By the same token, if you and I were friends, you would know me slightly differently than my friend Jeffrey knows me, or my friend Paul knows me. I think we're different to one another as well. Don't you think so?
That is absolutely true, Fred. You know, when I met my wife, I met her when I was 17 years old, and I had some very close friends at that time, but I understood that there was a side of me that came forward with her that, as much as I loved my other friends, did not quite come forward as much, and it was a slightly different Bill that showed up for that. That's absolutely true.
It's very true. We could talk about this the whole half hour, and I know you don't want to, but just as a case in point, I mean, I'll have a given friend that will never ask anything about me, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking about, what I'm feeling, what I'm worrying about, and I can enjoy that. And then I have another friend that won't let me talk about anything else with me.
Well, they each serve their own purpose. In a way, this is an interesting connection, but I have always felt that when I find a writer that I love, it's like making a friend. I think I made this comparison last week. First time I read Sun Also Rises, I thought, I want to hang around with this guy. This guy's like my buddy. And so you go to a writer for something different too, don't you? You don't go to each book, each writer for the same thing.
No. And the other thing, I was thinking about this because I was asked to write a long, participate in a long blog with Tim Ferriss. And one of the questions he asked me was, what are your favorite novels? Mm-hmm. And it completely stopped me short, your 10 favorite novels. And the reason it stopped me short is because I realized that the novels move around in time. And like you talk about The Sun Also Rises, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the last time I read The Sun Also Rises, it was like one of my all-time favorites, right?
Right.
It would have to be on the list. But the last time I read it right after one of those Norwegian spy novels. And I've been so paced up to reading quickly that when I tried to read The Sun Also Rises this way, it didn't work at all. I couldn't feel the poetry in it. Yeah. And I disliked it. And I had to kind of smack myself around and read it slowly again to fall in love with it again. But you know what I mean? Like at different points in your life, you love certain books, then you love them less, and you might love them more.
Yeah.
Are you like that?
Well, yeah, because it's going to speak to you at a certain time. It's a funny, as an example, I mean, this is a really – when I read The Lord of the Rings when I was 13,
right.
I thought this is telling – this is what I need. This is what I want. And I devoured that thing. And I just out of curiosity, when the movie came out, I picked it up again. And I couldn't believe how slow it was. I couldn't believe it ever got published almost. It was written so almost academically, at least the beginning. But when I was 13 years old, I couldn't put it down.
I know what you mean. And I mean, you know, the other book that comes to mind, we could talk about this with all books, I'm sure, is that like when I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac as a young guy, I was never more excited about a book than that book. I know. I sort of skirt it now because I don't want to be disappointed if I were to read it again. But does that make it less of a great book because I wouldn't love it as much now as I did when I was 20? You see my point?
Absolutely. And you know, as a writer, you put your book out there, and then I'm sure you had the experience of meeting your readers, and then each person gets something different from it. And I know you have been surprised by what some readers have told you it meant to them and what parts of it. Of what parts of your books have meant something to them. Have you had that experience?
Oh, my God. And with reviewers. I mean, like, I have gotten great reviews that upset the hell out of me.
Why?
Because it wasn't the book that I wrote. Or at least it wasn't
so
the book
thought.
That I felt.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't the book that I felt, you know. So it's so curious, the different manifestations of this kind of thing.
Well, but you know, the book is, whether you're writing fiction, and you know in nonfiction, because I just finished writing a memoir, too, about the relationship with my son, oddly enough. And your memoir is about taking stuff out, right? I mean, yes, you have to go and find detail, but it's about paring your life down to a thumbnail, almost, compared to the
book. Making choices is another way to say what you said.
Yeah, to make choices. So people can actually feel what's being said. And
right.
So that leaves, and the same is true of fiction, that leaves great big open spaces, and it's into those open spaces that your reader's own imagination goes, and that becomes their book and reviewers.
The spaces are huge. And I think a lot of young writers don't understand that. I mean, the spaces are what give the novel a resonance, and the relationship between what happens and the spaces. It's a part of the rhythm of a book. I can tell, agree about a lot.
It has a lot to do with it. And speaking of novels, so this is your first novel that you published, and you were saying to me before we went on air that this was also the first novel that you'd seriously attempted to finish, but you're not a 25-year-old MFA student. You're a guy who's had a writing career already. How was that?
When I was a young man, out of graduate school and finished a stint in college teaching, I settled in to become a novelist. And the way I went into it was to try to write short stories.
Right.
And my early short stories were a terrible struggle. And I didn't really understand what they should be about. I mean, I thought that they should be about my blues, my angst.
Yeah.
And I was tied up like a knot. And I think I did some interesting things, although I blush when I look them today, for the most part. And what I didn't understand as a young guy, and of course I wanted to write a novel because, like Mailer and Hemingway, I believed that the novel was the heavyweight champ of the form.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand the importance of story in a story.
Yeah.
And then I spent a stretch of years as a feature journalist writing mostly for the New York Times Magazine, but also for Esquire and New York Magazine and several others. And, of course, the mandate demanded that I write about real things that happen to exciting people in the world.
Right.
But for whatever reason, my editors allowed me to write in the first person, and my point of view was always a part of it. So I thought of it as creative journalism. I was kind of like an outsider as a journalist, and my editors put up with it.
Okay.
But it was preparing me to write fiction.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was learning how to put story in, and story is huge. And I think again, a lot of young writers don't understand that. And I didn't know how to write story. I knew how to write about what I felt. But
right.
I was preparing myself all along, and when I wrote my memoirs, I was getting closer to it. Now the last book that I wrote, about my parents growing up, the last Marlin, about my childhood and you know, growing up in a dysfunctional family, stylistically was very much like a novel in terms of the way it moved through time and the use of language. In fact, I was tempted to call it a novel at one point.
Yeah.
But then I said, I'll be straight and I'll call it what it is. But I think a lot of really good memoirs, and I'm curious to see what you think about this point. I think
I
a lot
agree.
Of really good memoirs are, I think, for example, This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff, he could have called it a novel. He was probably tempted to call it a novel.
Well, I think it's true. So I just finished one, and I was thinking about Townie by Andre Dubuis, which she put out about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
It reads like a novel. For sure, Wild, Cheryl Strayed's book, reads like a novel, and a first-person novel. And I think that the line between fiction and memoir should be paper thin in terms of, A, the feel of it, and also you kind of have to confess that, like, I can't remember everything that happened. And not that I'm inventing it, but in order to make this come to life, I've got to recount dialogue that I can't possibly have written down. And maybe I'm going to combine some memories because it works narratively. I mean, I give it as an example all the time that if I get into an argument with my wife and the argument lasts 20 minutes, and then we finally come to the end of the argument and we reach that point where we try to remember how we got there, each of us has a different memory. Of
right.
the things
and
that were said leading, that was 20 minutes ago. So
absolutely. Have you ever heard Tobias Wolff and Philip Wolff argue about their lives? Two brothers,
both who
wrote great memoirs,
yeah.
The Duke of Deception and This Boy's Life, and both of them saw their childhood completely differently.
Yeah, and just
so
saying,
I think there is. I think there is a lot of fiction in memoir. I think there's no question about it.
But the truth.
I mean, you feel it when you. But
no, go ahead.
No, you feel it when you read, for example, A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway.
And yes.
You can feel that he's making up so much of it.
Yeah,
but, I think you hit on it just a second ago. I'm sorry I'm riding over you, but I'm excited by this conversation. What is true, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post about a month ago. It was called that, What is True? And I sort of amplified that in terms of my own memoir writing, you know, just in terms... I was talking about the fact that when I wrote my last book, I was trying to remember what happened in my life, which I thought would be easy.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, I got from point A to point B, and then I didn't know how to get to the next point.
Yeah.
And I did certain things. I played the drums, which I used to do as a kid. I went fishing. I did certain things. And all of a sudden, I'm moving very quickly now because we have ground to cover. My life opened up to me. And I felt it all, and I was able to put it down, and it was like I was back there. I was smelling it. I was feeling it. I could smell my father again. But was it true? I mean, it was true in a way, but was it true?
You mean
true?
Was it factually true?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, in a way, it was true.
No. Here's what I think. I think the only truth is emotional truth. I think the only thing true is what you feel. The facts be damned. I'm not saying, I mean, I know that journalists have to get their facts down. That's one thing. But the thing that we remember is what life felt like. That's what we remember.
You're spot on. You're absolutely right.
Or we.
That's how it is for me.
That's all that matters.
Right.
You know, when I have arguments with my wife, I'm sounding as if that's all we do, but every once in a while I will get into a debate. And one thing I'll say is, look, here's what I felt like. I'm not saying it was the right thing to feel, but I felt hurt. I felt angry or happy, and whether that was right or not, but that was what I felt, and that's the reality of my life. Because when you write fiction, what are you writing about? You know what Dr. Rouse says. You're not writing about the fact that you're standing in the rain. You're writing about what it feels like to stand in the rain. What does feel like, you know, for all your characters? And so, all right, so now Fred Waitzkin says, I'm going to do the novel. I'm ready to go 15 rounds. And with another heavyweight, and so you must have felt grown up enough, and you know, you must have felt comfortable enough in your skin to take this on without all the chatter about who can be a novelist and who can't be.
Comfortable or desperate? Comfortable enough or desperate enough? I had to do it. I had to write this book.
Yeah.
But I thought about this book forever. I mean, I had this book in mind since 1984. You know, in 1984, I read a piece in Time magazine about the way they mine for gold in the Amazon, and I'll tell you about it quickly. They have these little empires in the jungle, and they're called Garimpos. And what they are little lawless kingdoms. Each one of them ruled by a kind of emperor, a murderous emperor. And what a Garimpo is basically is it's a gold mining camp. It's so deep into the jungle that it's like a penal colony. It's almost impossible to get to or get out of. It's surrounded by dense jungle, and there are wild animals all around, mainly jaguars. And it's a single man can't get from the Garimpo back to the main road, which is, let's say, 80 or 100 kilometers, because he'll be killed by the cats. He'd have to move in a team of men. And disease is rampant. And basically what the idea is that these miners are flown in from places like Manaus to work in the jungle so that they can bring fortunes out for their family. But it never happens because they dig in the mud pits for a month, and they get 2 or 3 ounces of gold. And then they smell the food emanating from the camp. And they hear Frank Sinatra, you know, coming out of the speakers. So they wander into the camp in the middle in the early evening, and of course there are women there. There's a brothel, but their women are beautiful. I mean, they're young and they're gorgeous. And a man spends the month's earnings in the night,
one night,
and then he goes back into the jungle again and does it for another month.
That's Sisyphean.
And, yeah, it is. It is. It absolutely is. And so I read about this, and I said, man, I gotta go write about this. It's so unlikely and violent and sensual. I signed a contract with Harper's Magazine to write a long piece about it. But a week later, I signed a more important contract to write Searching for Laurie Fisher for Random House. And I wrote that book about my son, and then two others. But I was still haunted by this jungle scene, you know? And then I wrote this book, this novel, and for the first 5 years, I was aiming to get it to the jungle. I mean, this was my home run idea,
right?
To write the last third of it in the jungle. So that's sort of an introduction to the novel.
Wow! It's so interesting how these things come to us. You just can't predict a goddamn thing about way ideas and how it will go. You can plot a book, but you cannot plot a life. It just can't happen, I don't think.
How they come to us. And how absurdly important they feel to us.
I know.
The Garimpo might not feel very important to you, but to me, it was everything.
No. Well, but that's the key, you know. And I think that's what writers do: is that an idea comes to you. You know, one of the worst things a writer can do sometimes, I think, is to tell somebody about their idea before they've really worked it out, because invariably, what they share, unless the idea is so crystally high concept that everyone can get it, it will feel more important to the writer than what they've shared, because your job is to take that thing inside you, which you feel the value of, but you can just see it, but it hasn't been given form, and give it form. And when you give it form, that's when everybody else can see the same thing. But until you give it, all you can do is feel the value. You can't. No one else can see it.
You mustn't talk about it with someone else until you're ready.
Yeah.
You mustn't. And if you talk about someone with someone else, you have to be so careful about the person you talk about it with that won't hurt it.
Yes.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, because they will
say. Until you're ready.
Because I remember I did it with a screenplay. I told my mom about it for some reason. I had worked it out, and I told her the basic story. And I said, well, that doesn't sound very interesting. And I thought, and she usually doesn't criticize. And so I thought to myself, I was a young man, but I thought, no, you haven't written it, so how can she know? And when I wrote it, she read it and said, oh, this is pretty good, because she just saw the sketch for it, the outline, and it wasn't interesting to her. And then that's our job, is to fill it in to the, And so, all right, so you wrote it, and did you? What was the hardest part of doing it? What was the hardest part of the novel?
Oh, the whole thing was hard. I mean, for me, it was very hard. I started I started, you know, I had it in mind to write about well, my dad was a salesman. He was a super salesman. He sold lighting fixtures in New York in the 50s during the building boom. And he sold more lighting fixtures in New York during a nine-year period of time. This is like for big buildings like the United Nations building and Seagram's building. Oh. He sold more of these fixtures than the next 50 top salesmen combined. I've referred to him as the Beethoven of fluorescence, which I think is a good one.
Oh, God.
And I had a mom that was an abstract painter, a student of Hans Hofmann and Willem de Kooning, who abhorred salesmanship, only loved God, didn't like my father at all. And they were divorced by the time I was 16. But I adored my father. I adored the ground that he walked on. And I wanted to be a salesman like him. And my mom found the idea appalling that her son would be a salesman and wanted him desperately to be a novelist. So in this book, I put it all together. I wrote a novel about a salesman, and I wrote the novel. You see?
Yeah, I know. It's great. But writers, in a way, it's so easy to become a salesman. Don't you? I mean, you are always – well, who has said everybody in America is selling something?
Hey, listen, you know, I had – you and I think about this. We come upon the same insight. I wrote not last week in an essay that I was writing, not last week, that I came to realize in my nonfiction life that a novelist is a salesman. Because he's selling his wares. If he's not a great salesman, why are you gonna buy it? Do you wanna read my stuff if I don't sell it well?
That's right. You are a kind of salesman, but you have to understand that the beauty of being a novelist is unlike someone who says, I'm a salesman, I'll sell what? Anything. I'll sell these brushes, these shoes, these whatever. You say, no, I'm selling this thing that I – well, this is the trick. You have to believe it's valuable before anybody tells you it is because no one knows why it's valuable, but you have to believe it. And if you don't believe it, why is anybody else going to believe it?
And as you said earlier, you have to hold it very close and protect it until it's ready. Because if you start showing it injudiciously, it can be injured. You can make mistakes with it. But anyway, getting back to your core question, so I started writing the novel, and I had this idea that I was gonna write it with an omniscient, from an omniscient point of view, like a Thackeray novel or something.
Yeah.
And I think mainly. I came to this brilliant idea because in my nonfiction, paradoxically, I always write in the first person, always. So I decided that I would do it the other way in the novel, but it didn't work at all. I mean, I went down the wrong road for 2 years, and the only way that I was able to make my protagonist come to life and make him feel intimate and make hopefully someone like you feel interested in him was to put a narrator into the novel that would be his friend, so you could understand why someone would like this guy or admire him,
even though he did terrible things. Yeah.
So that was one thing that slowed me down.
Yeah. Well, you have to learn these things, and the novels don't, you know, they don't come with their own roadmap. I always love this. When I interviewed Alice Hoffman, who's written 20... I don't know what it's up to now, 28 novels maybe, and she's had a fabulous career. When I interviewed her, she said, you know, every time I start a novel, I think, I don't know how to write a novel. Everyone!
But that's kind of beautiful.
Everyone! But it's true.
That's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, because you got to start again, you know? You got to start again. Go ahead.
So you give me an insight about this novel, and I'll respond to it. I'm curious, because you've got a great eye.
Well... you know, I was curious about the idea of manhood.
Right.
This book is a lot about manhood. And I was thinking about you and manhood, Fred, because of Bobby Fischer, the Searching for Bobby Fischer book. Because so much about manhood can become about competency.
Mm-hmm.
Competency. Your dad was competent, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the world.
Right.
He was a man of the world. And...
Right.
it is so easy to mistake your value, and this is what I thought of as I was reading the book, your value for your competency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got this son who's a prodigy. Is he more valuable than me? Because he's a prodigy.
Right.
I'm not a prodigy. That's what I was thinking about as I was reading. I don't know, did that come up for you, the idea of what is a man, what is manhood?
I would have responded to the subject in a slightly different way. I mean, I the way that subject speaks to me, and this is from a very different angle than you just articulated, would have to do with it with a certain kind of man, unconditional man love. And what I was getting at a little earlier was that in my relationship with my dad, I adored him irrespective of what he did. It didn't matter. He could cross terrible lines, and I would still love him and admire him. I think that that's something in the relationship between men. It's certainly something that Hemingway wrote about. And it was something that I wanted to get at. You know, like, for example, in Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, if you think about the relationship between Marlowe and Kurtz, Kurtz does even worse things than my protagonist, Jim.
Yeah.
But Marlowe still admires him, even at the end of the novel. He sees the horror of what Kurtz does, but he still admires him. And I find that very, very interesting between them.
It is, and I think it has to do with a central truth of human beings. You know, this to some degree I know it sounds like it's off the track, but to me it's immediately connected because the memoir I finished was about my son who was diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And it's a great temptation to judge people, that people's behaviors is who they are. But a behavior is a choice you make at a moment. And there is something else that a person is that is beyond a moment's choice. Does that make sense? So if you do something, your protector kills a man, that was a choice at that moment. Doesn't mean they're killing a man every single moment of every day.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's actually one of the themes of this book, because this character that I write about, Jim, I mean, he's absolutely a spectacular person at certain turns. In other words, I say at one point in the novel that he is the greatest friend that you will ever have.
Right.
Until he stops being your friend.
Right, right.
But that's okay in a way, right? Because what about those moments when, you know, I've always hated it when marriages break up after 25 years and all the guy and the woman will say about it is how terrible it was. You know that a lot of the first 10 years of their lives were wonderful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. You're together for a reason, and it's not just to punish each other. I don't buy that.
I don't believe that
that's the reason you came together. And I think that a lot of, you know, men's relationships has to do with being in the world together, going out together, going out on the hunt. You know, it all started with the hunt. And what does that mean, you know, to brave that together, to face that? You know, I used to feel that when I used to run track to some degree. Oh, it's time to go. I can't finish the story. I'll have to finish it later. Well, God, Fred, I feel like I just started talking to you, but now it's time to wrap up.
Hey, man, we just started this. This was a great talk. I've enjoyed it so much.
Oh, so did I. Well, listen, best of luck with this. I think the book's going to do well. Everybody, if you want a great and deep and meaningful adventure, read The Dream Merchant. You can't go wrong. Best of luck, Fred.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Well, everybody, wasn't that great? Oh, what a nice guy. See? I thought I knew him. Kind of thought I did, but I didn't. Now I know him a little bit better. So go out, write something you love, and maybe get to know yourself a little better. Because I'll tell you, every day I write something, I feel like I get to know myself just a little bit better. And the more I like myself, I got to say, the better I like myself. True story. See you next week, everyone.